Okay, we should be live in 1 second. That should work. And let me get the recording on as well. There we go. Okay, great. Yep, we're broadcasting. Okay, we're live. Hello, Heidi. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. Everybody who's joining us right now, we are about to start the Addiction 911 show. And our guests today, we have a couple of guests. Our other two guests have not joined us yet, but I'm sure they'll be coming on soon. But we do have Heidi here. And I want Heidi to tell, she's the love coach and everything about her. So Heidi, can you do your introduction for us? Because you can tell us all the great things that you do to help addicts in the community.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really grateful to be speaking and just kind of, you know, sharing with whoever's there. So I'm super happy to be here. So I'm Heidi McGurk, and I primarily work in the area of relationships. And I'm a teacher of self-love, self-esteem, dysfunctional family dynamics, family issues, relationship issues at Palm Partners Treatment Center in Delray Beach. I also have a private practice, and I co-facilitate and made the family program for Palm Partners. And every month we take families, we've taken hundreds of families through that program for the last 6 years. So my real pleasure, I work on all aspects. I work with clients and their families both. So
wonderful. That's fantastic, Heidi. That is great. I see that Mark has joined us. Hello, Mark. How are you today? I'm just looking down my phone just to check to make sure that we're, I want to see our broadcast live, make sure that our screens are switching. Okay, yes, I see Heidi up there. Perfect. So, Mark, how are you today? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and tell everybody what you do?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear
you. Okay, good. So thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, Christina, and I always enjoy the luncheons too. Those that don't know me, I'm an attorney, and my practice really is dedicated to helping families and individuals that are in crisis because of addiction and mental health. That's all we do. And sometimes that takes me into the criminal arena because people that are addicted to drugs, a lot of the time end up getting in trouble, right? Because there's only really, someone that has an addiction or mental health issue, there's only one of three places they can end up going: the morgue, prison, or treatment. Those are the options. And so I sort of get called in when options, you know, potentially options two and three are on the table. So sometimes I'm in criminal court trying to keep somebody out of prison and work out a treatment plan that a judge is going to accept so they can sort of start to move ahead with their life. And the other half of the time I'm in Marchman court. So we, for those that don't know, we have a civil process here in Florida that allows just about anybody with direct personal knowledge to have somebody involuntarily committed to a treatment facility so that their substance abuse and co-occurring mental health issue can be addressed. So we're busy, and we're getting busier because we're in the middle of a crisis right here in the U.S., and it's a nationwide crisis. And contrary to popular belief or what you read in the newspaper, there's a lot of great people down here in Florida doing a lot of great things to help people. So it's always a privilege and an honor to be, you know, to share sort of some airtime with other folks who are working in the treatment community to try and to make a difference. And that's what we're trying to do here at my law firm.
Well, thank you, Mark. And you brought up a great point. It is an absolute epidemic that we're facing. And this show is really dedicated today to all the people who love addicts, you know, whether that's your spouse, your child, your parent, friend, and you're really feeling desperate on how to help them. And we have two great perspectives here because we have Heidi's perspective, you know, coming from, with her background. And then, Mark, we have you with the legal and your expertise. So I want to dive right into this and go back and forth with the two of you. And, you know, let's start, you know, I'll start with Heidi. It's a huge, obviously, you know, you probably deal with a lot of families and friends of addicts. What is something or advice that you could give somebody right now, the most important thing they can do? I mean, there's probably several important things. What could they do right now to help that addict?
Well, obviously, There's so many different things that people can do. I'll just talk from my perspective and what I've seen over the years is probably the biggest challenge is that most families aren't really doing what they believe in anymore. They're doing whatever they think is going to work or keep somebody sober. And it really can be maddening for them, like a list of do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And they kind of get paralyzed, not really knowing. And so really, I help families figure out what is it that you believe in? You know, what do you really believe in? And the other piece of that is the biggest problem that I see, hands down, no doubt about it. And believe me, I'm not faulting anybody because I understand, but people take this disease personally. Family members take it personally. You know, somebody goes into treatment, they put all their hopes and dreams into that person and they relapse and they go, oh crap, you know, how could you do this to me? Instead of, you need more help. And so everybody's entitled to take it personally because it affects people personally. But where is the outlet that families are going to get the support that they need to process their feelings? Because while they're stuck in the feelings around the relapse or the addiction, people are dying because we're just not moving on getting them help. It's like, you know, and I know that, you know, people say, oh, it's not like cancer, but disease is disease. So if somebody said, hey, you know, I have cancer and the cancer came back, you wouldn't be like, you jerk. You know, you'd go, oh, honey, the cancer's back. Let's go back into treatment. Let's do what we need to do. And so I really help people kind of detach in moments of crisis from their disappointment around their expectations around how recovery is supposed to look and really tune into what's going to be the best strategy to help save lives, ultimately, you know, help people be better.
And you bring up a really good point about the comparison to cancer, which we've talked a lot about on all of our shows with codependency. I guess the difference is somebody playing the devil's advocate would say, well, you know, somebody with cancer is not stealing from me or, you know, causing me the tremendous financial hardship or getting violent or, you know, so there's a lot of, I think, stigma and anger and lack of understanding about the disease of addiction.
Really compare it to Alzheimer's. Okay. So like, because addiction really is a brain disease. And so it's a broken part of the brain, you know, it's a brain disease. And I know this isn't the show for that, but educating the families to understand that it's like, you know, in Alzheimer's, people can say some really scary things or do some really scary things. And we don't get mad at them for being like mentally incapacitated. And addiction is the only thing that we actually are under the delusion that people have access to their neocortex or the thinking part of the brain, that they're doing this on purpose. And really, nobody's home. Nobody's home. Just like in Alzheimer's, nobody's home. So, you know, families really getting the education and the latest, because there's a lot of misinformation about addiction still being perpetuated. But the latest brain science, the latest interpersonal neurobiology that teaches really, you know, how the disease works. And education is key, because if we don't have that, we literally take everything personally. Because why wouldn't we?
Right, that's a very good point. Mark, what is your feelings about that? That's interesting. I haven't heard that analysis about Alzheimer's and addiction. But what are your thoughts about that?
Actually, I think Heidi brings up a really great point, which is why I always love sharing the air with people like Heidi who know a whole lot more about it than I do. So I sort of speak just from personal perspective, but I think the comparison with Alzheimer's or especially cancer is very well taken. You know, I mean, I always tell people that somebody – you don't necessarily cure somebody of cancer. We get them into remission. And I don't think you necessarily cure somebody of addiction. You get them into recovery. So, you know, it's an ongoing process. And the conversation I have with families, and I actually had one with a dad yesterday who called me from New York, was that, you know, look, it's not a magic pill. I mean, you know, it's not like go to treatment, get fixed and never have to work on it again. It's, you know, I mean, you could go to a lot of places and get clean. The question is, can you stay clean and can you stay in recovery? And I think that's the battle that most addicts face. And I think that's the conversation that I have routinely with families and explain to them that the Marchman Act, just like treatment, is not a magic pill. I can get your loved one into treatment, but they got to do the work. And then you have to understand that they have to make a lifestyle change. I mean, this is something that they're going to have to work on for the rest of their life. They're going to have to take steps to maintain sobriety, to stay in recovery. And I think I think that's, you know, probably a similar conversation that Heidi and, you know, has with her clients, right? I mean, it's for them to understand that. And the second thing that I think is a difficult conversation to have, even from a lawyer's perspective, is, and I think this, maybe this applies to all lawyers in terms of how we deal with things. So we're so trained as problem solvers. You know, we always think of everything as a legal problem. And I can tell you that it's, that when a client comes to you, whether it's to deal with something like addiction or whatever, maybe they're losing their home in foreclosure, that it's not just a legal problem. The legal problem is a tiny piece of it. It's a personal problem, right? This is why mom and dad are fighting. And sometimes I get, you know, parents come to me and mom wants to send to treatment and dad doesn't want to do it. But, you know, it's affecting their relationship. And so, I mean, it is, addiction permeates the entire family. The entire family is an emotional crisis. And I think I realized that, you know, as I think I've talked about, I lost my own father at the beginning of the year, a week after my 50th birthday, January the 15th. But for 2 years before that, thank you. But for 2 years before that, you know, my mom and I were busy either calling 911 or rushing my dad to the emergency room. And I really remember as I would see my father lying there in a hospital bed with tubes coming out of everywhere they can possibly come out of, you know, here's my father lying there, you know, tied to all these machines. And I'm looking at my mom and I'm looking at my brother, I'm looking at my sister, and I could see the look in their eyes, you know, this emotional toll that it takes. And one of the first times that I sat with a family who was dealing with addiction, you know, looking at a potential Marchman Act, I saw the exact same look in their face. And so I think that, one of the most important things that I deal with, even though I'm not a therapist, is to understand the emotional component that's going on here, because these people come to you because they're desperate and they don't know what to do and they want answers, and it is slowly sucking the life out of everybody in the family and it's destroying the family unit. So I, as much as I'm not a therapist, I try to play a little bit of therapist, and I'm always more than happy to direct a family to somebody for them to talk to, because they need to understand sometimes the emotional component of what's going on here. And while I can sort of help them to understand the legal process of what I can and cannot do, the options I can offer them, from an emotional perspective, people like Heidi are really just a godsend. And so, you know, I think what she said was, her points that she made were excellent. And, you know, sometimes I have similar conversations with my families. I just don't have her training and background to perhaps explain it in such eloquent terms.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point that you make here, Mark, that about the fact that, you know, we have, you know, this emotional element that's draining the families. But then there's also the legal element where, you know, we don't put people with Alzheimer's or cancer in jail, and we do with addicts. So there's that stress as well. So Heidi, I want to bring, you know, have you and Mark really talk about this. You know, we bring up the conversation of someone's watching right now and they're just emotionally drained. They don't know what to do anymore. It's really affecting their life. What is your advice to that family member to take care of themselves? How do they survive this while hoping, like you said, and praying that their loved one gets treatment?
That's a great question. I think the way to start to come out of that is to be really compassionate with yourself first, and understand that everything that a family has been doing or going through or experiencing has been out of love, out of, you know, desire to help, to make a difference, you know, and that's all wonderful and important. And like Mark was saying with the Marchman Act, you know, sometimes, you know, where people would just say, oh, hey, just pull out of there, just pull out, right? Just go take care of yourself. You there's nothing you can do. You have no control. Let's be realistic. There's family members that are never going to pull out. Okay. That they're going to be in there, that they're not going to go take care of themselves. That's not an option for them. It's their daughter. It's their son. It's their husband, right? They're not going to sleep. They're not going to eat, you know, the way that they need to. And so really it's having compassion and understanding that they're doing what they're doing because they love, because they want to help. And it's helping them do that, what they believe in, but also get support around what the other parts of it. It's not all or nothing. Okay. It doesn't have to be, oh, just pull out, leave it, go to Al-Anon, forget it. You know, there is a way to help that's going to be more effective. And what I tell the families is, even if they are the best sponsor and they're in the program themselves, they're an excellent psychotherapist, or, you know, they're still too close to the situation. So the best thing a family can do for their loved one is they stop trying to be the hero and fix everything, but supply the right people in order to help. Get the life coach, get the therapist, get the attorney, get the people, you know, help them have access to these people if that's something they can help with, or recommend pointing in the right direction, because mom isn't mom anymore. Mom's a halfway house, a treatment center, a life coach, a therapist, an attorney. And that's why she's making herself crazy, is that she can't just be a mom anymore. And so it's really helping parents understand their roles, what they have control over and what they don't, but never telling them, just go take care of yourself. That's unrealistic. No, they're in it because they love, they care, they want to be supportive. So it's, how can you be supportive? What's the best strategy?
Absolutely. But a lot of the advice that is given to family members is, you know, the thing, the borderline of codependency and tough love. And there is, you know, there's many, many professionals will say, you know, just walk away, you know, let them, you know, they have to, their butt has to hit the ground. They have to, you know, fail, hit that rock bottom, whatever that is. And it's, I always felt like that is such, just from having, you know, knowing people who've been going through this, have went through this, a contradiction, especially for somebody, you love somebody and you have to walk away from them or do the tough things or put them in jail or, you know, call it in. And there's a lot of different advice on that. So I'd like to get both of your opinions on that. Mark, we'll start with you, and then I'll come back to Heidi. What, you know, what are your feelings on that? I mean, should it, should the family member, like Heidi said, you know, it's you know, they try to take care of yourself and, you know, just tell that, you know, you have to at that point do tough love, or do you suggest what Heidi's saying, like just to have more of, you know, to be more involved and not tell them to pull out of the situation?
Yeah, you know, I've heard that term rock bottom before, and parents said to me, "Well, should I let them hit rock bottom?" Well, what if rock bottom means overdosing and, you know, going to the emergency room? I mean, how many times do you want to experience that? You know, how long are you going to let that process go on before, you know, you're sorry that you didn't take action? So, you know, in terms of, and I've heard the tough love thing too. You know, should I just let them do their thing? No, if you want to do tough love, then make the decision that they can't make, which is to get themselves into treatment. And, you know, sometimes parents don't say, well, if he or she really wanted to go to treatment, they'd have done it. And I'm like, no, you got to understand something. You know, this is a Jekyll and Hyde thing. They're not capable of making that decision. Your son or your daughter is not, you know, they're not there right now. They're whatever they're addicted to, that's sort of running the show. And so you got them, if you want to help them, then make the decision for them to get them into treatment, you know. And I, you know, I'll always give them access to all the free resources I possibly can. But from a legal perspective, the tough love thing is making the decision to get them into treatment, which means filing the Marchman Act, right? And it's not unusual for me to have, you know, son or daughter on one side of the courtroom and mom or dad on the other side of the courtroom. And I think from what I've seen, you know, as human beings, we have this, you know, our subconscious mind is somewhat programmed to keep us safe, right? So we have this, you know, and safe means what we're used to, right? You know, what we, our norm, which is why we always are uncomfortable with change. And for an addict, you know, the norm is, you know, getting high all the time or whatever, you know, they're doing, you know, this sort of what we would think of as irrational behavior. But in the sort of front part of the brain, there's this rational part of the brain, which kind of sort of knows they need help. But, and this, so there's this internal conflict going on. And so, my experience is if the family member makes the decision for them, you take that conflict away. And I see it in their face when we sit in court. It's almost like there's relief. They haven't had to make that decision anymore because somebody else has made it for them. And maybe they feel like, you know, the judge is making it for them, or I'm making it for them, or whatever it is. But in my experience, I think that you got to make the decision for them. They can't make it for themselves. So if, you know, whatever, however you look at it, tough love, rock bottom, you know, compassion, whatever it is, you got to make the decision for them, because if you don't make the decision for them, then things only get worse with time. They never get better with an addict, and you just have to do that. So, I mean, that's sort of my personal perspective, and maybe Heidi, you can help us to understand, you know, what really goes on in the brain. But that's just from what I see and what I know.
I love what you said, Mark. I love what you said, because I just want to piggyback on it, because I think it's so important that tough love is not turning your back and saying, well, just do whatever and you'll make kind of decision, because they don't have, in addiction, that reptilian part of the brain is where the addiction lives, in the mid to low brain. And it's being hot to the,
turning your back and saying, well, just do whatever and you'll,
oh, I'm hearing a feedback.
Yeah, it's okay. I fixed it. It was my phone. I was just double checking. Okay. Making sure. Sorry.
So what I was saying is they don't have access to the rational brain. So when you're assuming this position of they'll just figure it out, they don't have access to the neocortex to figure it out when they're active in their disease. So tough love is, I'm going to make it uncomfortable by saying, I believe that you have to go to treatment. That's tough love. Tough love is you need treatment. Tough love is I'm not going to, you know, what we enabling is, taking somebody in, Googling how to detox them in your back bedroom, right? Trying to understand how to get somebody better. That is giving them money when you know where the money is going. Tough love is really misunderstood. It's not like turning your back. It's doing the hard thing, which is probably making them hate you, right? Which is, honey, sorry, like Mark's talking about, they're in court. The kid is like, I hate you. I can't believe you're doing this to me. And the parents are like, heart wrench, like, oh my God, I can't believe are we really doing this, honey? Are we really doing this? But if that child actually sees it through and goes through that Marchman Act and goes through treatment, the odds of that person looking and saying, oh my God, thank you for saving my life, that's tough love. Tough love is not just turning your back and hoping and detaching from what happens. It's doing what you believe in. And a lot of parents that I work with believe in getting their child help, no matter what, always helping. The problem is trying to do it on their own.
But the problem is, I mean, from just personal experience, having friends who've gone through this, what happens when you do make that decision, you get your child or loved one, your child over the age of 18, they're not really a child anymore. I know there's the Marchman Act, but what happens if they continually leave the treatment center? They leave rehab, they constantly leaving, they won't go. They feel, you know, they've been Marchman Act several times, and you're dealing with a situation like that. When does it become, you know, what do you do at that point? When do you say enough is enough? You know, it's your decision, because you say make the decision, but yet it's not that easy a lot of times. I know a lot of people who are watching will say that, you know, we've tried, we've begged, we've done intervention, we've, you know, asked them to go, either they won't go or they go and then 24 hours later they're out. You know, so Mark, what is your opinion on that?
You know, in all the time I've been doing the Marchman Act, I've had.
Can you guys hear me still?
Yes.
Yes. We're frozen.
No, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
There you go. I see you, Mark.
Okay. All right. And I can hear you. So, you know, in I've spent 23 plus years now working in the criminal justice system, and the last two and a bit doing the Marchman Acts. And I've had great success with it. I have not had a child walk out. You know, I think when they're sitting in court and the judge says, listen, I'm letting you know, I'm giving the treatment center the authority to keep you for 9 days. And if you don't go or you walk out, I'm going to put you in jail. That seems to be a pretty good wake up call for them. So I haven't had that problem. But that being said, if they do walk out, yeah, I'm going to ask the court to hold them in contempt and throw them in jail, because you know what? They're better off in jail than they are out in the street. I mean, that's the reality. So, I mean, from that perspective, you know, I think that the Marchman Act is a very, very useful tool. Is it perfect? No, I think there are some holes in it. And I've, you know, certainly had that conversation on a number of, you know, occasions with the Sober Homes Task Force here in Palm Beach County. I think it needs to be amended, but it's a great first start and it's a great tool, and it's so underutilized. It's frankly shocking to me. So, you know,
tell us more though, just because it's going to be people watching from all over the country here, not just in Florida. So can you just briefly explain, is the Marchman Act available in all states or different variations of it? And what is just a brief overview of the process?
Okay, so there are about, I think it's 37 states that have some type of involuntary commitment statute. And they're a little all over the place. Some of them are like our Baker Act, which only deal with mental health. Some of them are like the Marchman Act that deal with substance abuse and a co-occurring mental health, and some of them only deal with substance abuse, and there's really no uniformity. But in Florida, I think we have I think the Marchman Act's a really great piece of legislation in that it now recognizes, and it didn't a few years ago, but it now recognizes the fact that a lot of the time mental health and substance abuse go hand in hand. And I can't tell you what comes first. Sometimes mental health comes first, and then addiction, and sometimes addiction, and then it's mental health. But whatever it is, a lot of the time, 9 times out of 10, both issues have to be addressed. So basically, it's a two-step process that will allow somebody with direct personal knowledge to petition the court to have the person made to go into treatment. Part one is a 5-day hold for assessment, stabilization, and detox. And that can be done on an ex parte basis, meaning that I'm going to sit with the family probably for a couple hours, get a full history of what's been going on, the how, why, when, you know, drug of choice, all those material things that the court's going to want to hear. I'm going to file a legal pleading. The court's going to review it. And if it's legally sufficient, they're going to send the sheriff out to go and get that person and take them to a treatment center where they're going to be held for 5 days. And it's going to be done so they don't know about it. So, I mean, obviously, we don't want to give them a heads up because then they're going to run away most of the time, right? Because they don't want to go. If they wanted to go, they would have gone. So we make that decision for them, and we have them taken to a facility where they're held for 5 days. During that 5-day period, I'm now going to file a second petition, and I'm going to ask the court to send them to treatment for a period of up to 90 days. And at that point, the respondent, the person on the other end of the Marchman Act, is entitled to come in and contest the allegations and basically have like a small trial in front of a judge. They're entitled to counsel if they can't afford a lawyer, and they're allowed to, you know, contest the allegations that have been made against them more often than not by either mom or dad. So, I mean, you know, that's kind of what it is in a nutshell. But on the other hand, if they don't comply with a court order and there's a finding they need the treatment, then, you know, they risk going to jail. So it's a civil process with a potentially criminal penalty in terms of jail. So that's what it is. And the good thing I think about it is that it's completely confidential, which means that there's no record of it. No one's going to be able to go to the clerk of court's website and see it. And even the actual hearing itself is done in a confidential manner, meaning that unless you are either, you know, a petitioner or a respondent or a lawyer involved in the process, no one can come in the courtroom and see it. So, you know, I think it's the confidentiality helps too, because there's always sort of that social stigma that, you know, my son or my daughter's an addict and, you know, now everybody's going to be saying things about me, when in truth, just about everybody knows an addict, just like everybody knows somebody who has cancer. So I don't know if there really is that social stigma, but I know that mom and dad typically worry about it. But, you know, that's what it is in a nutshell. So
great explanation. And Heidi, Mark talks about, you know, Mark would be an example on the team. Heidi had brought up about having a team and having a great lawyer, a drug and alcohol lawyer, which many people don't think about, is a great addition to the team. So Heidi, tell us your thoughts on the Marchman Act, about creating a team, getting parents and loved ones proactive, so you empower them so that they feel like there is something they can do. What is your thoughts on that?
Well, I just, you know, I think that addiction really isn't about addiction, okay? It's not about drugs and alcohol at all. Addiction is about, is your loved one's lame attempt at happiness. It's their lame attempt at trying to be happy. And it's a lame attempt. It's not working. It's not sustainable. And so nobody set out, you know, to go down this path. But unfortunately, when they're on that path, the road isn't just go to treatment. That is an exceptional start. So treatment is on the team, right? Somebody goes away to a treatment center. 90 days is really ideal for a situation like that. But it's like, if addiction isn't about drugs or alcohol, it's not about go to treatment and stop doing drugs. It's about, why was I doing drugs or alcohol in the first place? And really, it's an unfulfilled life. So understanding that sobriety is really about your loved one pursuing happiness and pursuing a fulfilling life and, you know, pursuing whatever they need to do in order to make that happen. So for some of your loved ones, it's going to be that they have past things they need to deal with that are still causing them pain, anxiety, depression. Sometimes it's a dual diagnosis, so they need a psychiatrist on the team. Sometimes they need a trauma therapist on the team. Sometimes they need a life coach on the team because they don't have a mission or purpose in life. And sometimes they need a relationship coach on the team because their intimate relationships are really their source of struggle. It's really up to your loved one to figure out what it is that they need, who they need on their team. And the role of the parent is, if they can and if they believe in it, to provide resources and detach from the outcome. You don't provide a resource like, okay, honey, well, halfway housing or life coaching, yes, I'm going to pay for that if you're going to stay sober. Well, then don't pay for it. Don't support it if you can't detach from the outcome of it. Do what you believe in so you can sleep at night, so you know that you gave your loved one every opportunity, but you can't make them take the opportunity. You can provide it and detach from the outcome. And then you know you're doing what you believe in. Well, I'm going to provide a life coach for you because I believe in that, not because I think it's going to keep you sober. Too many people are doing what they think is going to work instead of what they believe in. If you believe in not doing anything at all, then do that. If you believe in detaching and going and living and letting them do it all on their own, then do that. It really is about finding what's going to work for you so that at the end of this road, if your loved one doesn't make it, that you can put your head on your pillow at night knowing you did everything you believed in. And that's really what this journey is about.
And that is a really great point that you bring up, because the root of addiction, we talk all about how to cure addiction, how to, you know, get people clean and sober. And addiction boils down to pain, trying to mask pain, whether that's emotional pain or, like, we see a lot of addicts recently on heroin because they were in physical pain. And they are trying to get out of physical pain. If anybody's ever been in pain, I get migraines and it's horrendous. And, you know, you get to the point you'll do anything. And for me, I can't take any, barely any medicine other than Tylenol. But there are people who have, you know, serious surgeries and issues. And then the doctors give them those pain medicines. And then they can't get them anymore. And now they're on the street. So they're trying to mask pain. And then you have the other component, which is more common, is that whole emotional issue from, you know, all these different issues that you brought up from childhood, from just being unhappy, that whatever they try, whatever substance they try temporarily makes them happy. So I think that's really overlooked. Like, it's not that it's overlooked, but it's the root, you know, it comes down to the pain. People are addicted because they're in pain and they're trying to, you know, get rid of that pain. So putting together a team, like you suggested, that's great advice, with excuse me, relationship coaches and all different types of, you know, and then you have, again, the mental illness. And that, again, that also is trying to mask pain. Somebody who's, you know, bipolar or manic depressive, and they're in pain, they're depressed, they're trying to get out of pain. Whatever they're taking makes them feel better. So I think that's a really great point. And I think for people to realize when you're trying to help your addict that your addict is in pain, tremendous.
Well, not just always in pain. So people do things for one or two reasons: to avoid pain or gain pleasure. So they're either, right. There could be pain that they're avoiding, or they're pursuing pleasure, and they're pursuing pleasure in all the wrong places. So it's helping them figure out where they're going to get their pleasure from that's sustainable and that isn't destructive. So it's avoid pain or gain pleasure. Did I lose you guys?
I'm here. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, I can hear you. Do we lose Christina?
I don't know. Christina, can you hear us? Can you hear us, Christina?
I don't know what happened there.
Christina, can you hear us?
I think we might have froze.
Oh, there she is.
I can't hear her, and I think she might have froze for a second there. I can hear you, Mark, though. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and I think Heidi and I can hear each other,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I think Mark froze. I think
No, I'm here.
We're frozen for a sec. Might be just something with the streaming. There you go.
Okay.
So that's a really good point you were saying, though, about Heidi, about pleasure. You're right.
Now she froze. Can you hear me, Heidi?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, my husband and I, who created this family program, came from Tony Robbins. I don't know if you guys
know
who that
Doug.
Is. Yeah, okay. So Doug, he came from Tony Robbins. And we teach a lot of that life strategies here at Palm Partners, which is just about how to make an extraordinary life. You know, it's not just about addiction. It's really going beyond addiction to create an extraordinary life.
Yeah, I bumped into your husband at Moments of Change. He's a great guy.
Oh, okay, good. I'll tell him my talk.
Knows me.
So, Christine, yeah, you both. Yes, I can hear you. Great, we're back. Yeah, this is what live streaming is all about. So, So the great point Heidi brings up, and you bring up, Mark, about you know, when you're dealing with this about pleasure and pain and gravitating toward one or the other, and maybe it's just understanding. I think a lot of us have anger toward addicts. Many people, you know, our loved ones or family members, because we figure, you know, why can't they just stop? Because we're not addicts, so we don't understand, like Heidi was saying before, this is a brain disorder, this is something, you know. So being proactive and taking the steps, and I think finding someone like yourself, Mark, is really crucial, as well as Heidi, to handle the legal aspects of that and to know your options. I think many people don't know. Other than Marchman Act, I know there is, there's some other routes too. If somebody is, say, dual diagnosis, and how hard it is. I know someone who tried this, it was very difficult to get the dual diagnosis child into a mental facility, and that seems to be very difficult to do in this day and age. So if you have someone who is, you know, dual diagnosis, not taking their meds and, you know, doing drugs, what would the process be for that?
So I think if they're dual diagnosis, because the Marchman Act allows for somebody who's got a co-occurring mental health issue, I think you can still use the Marchman Act because, you know, to handle it, because a lot of the time, if they're not, you know, the clients that every once in a while I get a chance to talk to one of, you know, to either a client in a criminal case, right? Because then it's my client or the respondent. And, you know, I ask them, you know, tell me what's going on. Why do you do what you do? Because I like to understand that. And I think that makes me a better practitioner from a legal standpoint, if I can understand what's really going on. And, you know, what they'd say to me is, makes me feel better. It makes me feel better. That's it. That's exactly what they say most of the time. So, I mean, you know, to go along with what Heidi said, obviously there's something going on that they need to be made to feel better. Now, you know, I don't know from a clinical perspective what it is. It could be physical pain. It could be mental pain. Maybe there, maybe there's trauma going on. You know, you get somebody, I had family recently that I sat with where, you know, they had a daughter who was 30 years old, and for, I don't know, since she was 16 years old, she'd been abusing, you know, various types of medications. And one of the things the family revealed to me was that, you know, 2 years before they found out she was using, she'd apparently been sexually abused by a teacher, and it just didn't go. They didn't do, for whatever reason, that issue was not addressed. And, you know, I said, look, you know, I spent a lot of time in the criminal justice system here, and I think that your daughter was sexually assaulted, and you've tried to medicate, you know, you're trying to medicate the situation when you haven't really addressed the trauma issue. And now she has a significant mental health issue. And we had a very difficult time, you know, finding the right place for her, because whatever place that she went to, she was getting Baker acted 2 days in. So, you know, one of the other things that we also do as part of the process is we like to file what's called an ETG, an emergency temporary guardianship. And the ETG tends to piggyback the Marchman Act, because what it does is it gives the family at least temporary control over medical decisions, access to medical records. And if there are finances that are being drained, it gives them control of that too. So, I mean, we do a couple of things to try and give the family as much control as we can. But I think going along with what Heidi says, there's so many dynamics to somebody who's addicted, and, you know, it's not, there's no one size fits all. So, you know, having somebody like Heidi as part of the team to figure out what's really going on, you know, was there a sexual assault 20 years ago that nobody bothered to do anything about, or was just some other type of trauma. I mean, whatever it was, you kind of need to get to the root cause. So, you know, I know doctors call it triaging, and I got two doctors in the family, so I try to do the same with my clients, but you got to find out what's going on, because otherwise you just can't medicate your way out of that. You know, you can't treat your way out of that unless you know what's really going on. And so, you know, the highest point, when you can find out what the root cause is, then you can find out what the right modality of treatment is. And so, you know, having a great team, to what Heidi says, is really, really critical. It's essential.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Heidi, I would like to ask you, based on your opinion, because just so it's clear for people who are watching or maybe very confused, like we touched upon before about people who are told, you know, cut the person off, you know, don't give them. Well, what are your thoughts on not giving money, kicking them out of the house, you know, setting boundaries? I mean, sometimes you've got, you know, family members coming in, they're stealing, and there's younger children in the house and they're using in the house. What are your suggestions to families who are coping with that, trying to deal with that right now while trying to help their loved one?
So again, I think that's why it's so important to work with the families, kind of like there's no one size fits all, just like with the addict or alcoholic, because different families believe in other things. I have a family I'm working with right now that the daughter is home, and what they believe in is, as long as she's doing well, they love having her home. Although there's a time frame on how long she can be home, and I help families really figure that out. How long, what are the parameters, where is she, what's she contributing to? And there, I have other families who say, I don't want them home at all, because that's what they believe in. They don't want them to be at home. And they say, they just need permission. Families need permission to do what they want to do versus what they think that they're supposed to be doing. Right. There are situations where it's dangerous. If more people die in their parents' back bedroom with a belly full of meatloaf than they do homeless on the streets, because it's easier to overdose when you're taking care of all their needs. That's why it's better not to house them when they're being high. That kind of stuff, absolutely common sense. You know, if somebody's getting high downstairs in your room, they need to go to treatment. In any instance at all, you should not tolerate that in your home. That person is sick. They're going to die if they do not get help. So if somebody's using in your home, that's a no-brainer to me, because that person should be in treatment, not in a home.
And if they won't go,
then what do they believe in? Do they believe in being a hospice nurse? Because that's what they become at that point, because that child likely it will not survive. Or do they believe in, I can't watch you do this to yourself, and I don't want your brothers and sisters to be subjected to it, so we love you, but we can't have this in our home. It's what right. do they Setting believe boundaries. In? Setting boundaries. Some of my families who come to our family workshop, like one day there was a woman in the back and she raised her hand and she was like, well, look, she was 65 years old. She goes, I'm taking care of my daughter's toddler and my daughter keeps going in and out of treatment and I don't want this baby. I don't want to take care of this baby. Mm-hmm. And there were women in the front that gasped. They were like, can you believe it? She better take care of that baby. They were so mad. And I applauded that woman in the back and I said, it's not about what you should or shouldn't do. It's doing what you believe in for you. If you don't want to take care of that toddler, then it's okay for you to say, I don't want this responsibility. You're not a bad person because you say, I don't want this in my house. You're not a bad person because you say, I don't want to raise your children. You're not a bad person, right? And so we're so worried about how it's going to look or, you know, what people think. Like Mark was saying, there's a lot of stigma still, even though it's every 1 in 10 people are wrestling with addiction, right? But there's still this stigma about it. You know, I can tell you that one of the hardest decisions one of my families made was her daughter was using in the house. She'd been in and out of treatment and she would not go. And she had other kids in the house and she would not go to treatment. This girl refused. And the mother said, you cannot wreak havoc in this home anymore. I love you. Here are your bags. You can't be here. That mother was in excruciating pain. That daughter ended up having things happen to her when she went homeless for a while, but she ended up coming back to treatment and she ended up, you know, thriving and surviving. The mom still has guilt around, but the daughter didn't have things happen to her on the street because the mom put her out on the street. The daughter had things happen to her on the street because she was a drug addict, unwilling to get help at the time. I think parents take everything like it's all their responsibility. Everything they do is what, you know, is making the addict do this or do that. This person has a mind of their own that's hijacked. So you don't have any control. So if you have other kids in the house and you don't want them to be a part of this and it's ripping the family apart, the only thing you can do is say, I love you and you can't be here in this home. It's excruciating, but to protect your family, to protect the other children that are in the house, to protect your own sanity, you have to make some tough decisions. It doesn't mean you don't leave them with the option to say, go to treatment. Let's try Marchman Act. Let's do whatever we can. Let's hire Mark. It means that you give all the resources and then you finally detach from the outcome because you have no control.
And that's, and you just said it, you have no control. And I think that is the hardest thing for a parent. Or not even a parent, you know, a wife, a husband, you know, a child of an addict, didn't realize you have no control over that other person. They, at the end of the day, no matter what you want, they're going to, whether they, you know, make the ultimate decision, they have to want to get help. And that's really, really hard for people, especially for mothers, because mothers think, you know, like you said, we think we can fix everything. You know, our child's in pain, we're going to fix it. You know, and it brings me to a question, you know, Mark, you mentioned about, I wasn't sure the exact term, but about like getting a guardianship over an addict, an adult child, let's say. Does that come with any risks? Let's say you do, you know, have guardianship over the adult child and their finances and they go out and they commit a crime or they, is there any liability? Because I've heard this before that people were nervous about that addict doing something where they would be sued, the family would be sued. if there was a guardianship in place?
I have to tell you that if that is the case, that would be news to me. But you know, my place of peace is I teach martial arts. That's sort of the thing I do for 3 times a week when my calendar permits. And one of the things, you know, an old instructor of mine taught me was to be sorry for what I did do, not what I didn't do. So be sorry you put your kid into treatment. Don't be sorry that you didn't put him into treatment. So I think that's, you know, be sorry you filed for a guardianship. Don't be sorry you didn't. You know what I mean? That kind of thing.
Right. And I think many people don't even realize that's an option, that they could get a guardianship, or maybe they're given this wrong information by friends and families and, oh, no, you don't want to do that because now, you know, God forbid they do something, you're liable. And so it's good to know that that's something that's not, you have not seen, and it's probably not going to happen. And it's more important to have that guardianship. So it's as simple as if you're an addicted adult son or daughter, or, you know, goes, or you have no rights as a parent, if you don't have that, like even medical wise, the hospital probably won't speak to you sometimes. They could, right? Legally, they could say, well, you know, right, you're not on this person's list.
Right. In fact, we like to use the guardianship as a standalone when we're dealing with somebody who has a mental health issue. We have a client right now, where the child, you know, went backpacking through Europe and, you know, did various types of opioids and fried his brain and whacked out the chemistry in his head. And so he's not using right now, but he's got a significant mental health issue. So we're using the guardianship to get control that way. So, you know, it's not always with the martial, but it can be used standalone. To one of the things that Heidi said, you know, I think that as people that work in this sort of arena, clients need to know, patients need to know when they come to see us, it's a no judgment zone, right? We're not here to judge people. And if you're the kind of person that wants to sort of, you know, judge a family for what they did or didn't do, or, you know, you want to judge a, you know, a young person because they were doing this or doing that, then you're probably working in the wrong business. I mean, it's got to be a no judgment zone, because when clients come to us, whether they're coming to Heidi or they're going to treatment or they're coming to me, they're coming to us because they are absolutely desperate. Right. We are, you know, a lot of the time we're the port of last call, as it were, and they just don't know what to do because they've tried to manage the situation themselves and realize they can't do it. And so I think the most important thing is, as you know, Heidi said, it's whatever you did in the past is what you believed in. It's what you made the decisions. You know, you tried to make the right decisions at that time based on the information you had. And I think that, you know, most parents who are in that situation try to do that, right? They try to make the right decision at the time. And even if it turned out to be wrong, and so sometimes they get that, you know, that they feel guilty, you know, if they didn't make the right choice. But so we have to be sort of, you know, non-judgmental, because they're looking to us as not just as a lawyer, but as a counselor, right, to help to make, at least to give them some feeling that there is a possible answer to the situation they haven't been able to find an answer to. So I think, you know, to what Heidi said is, yeah, whatever they did, right? It's what we can do moving forward to perhaps remedy the situation or help them to move forward in a positive direction. So.
Absolutely. And I would say don't go it alone, because I think a lot of the shame, there's a tremendous amount of shame, you know, in addiction when you have a loved one who's addicted, and you don't want people to know, and people find out, like you said, you blame yourself, or they look at you and they judge you. And what I found is that the addiction community here in South Florida especially is just a wonderful, everybody I've met have been so wonderful and caring and non-judgmental. Many are former addicts who are very successful now. So if you're out there and anywhere in the country, you know, there's these wonderful people who are there for you. Don't be, you know, afraid to get help, to speak to somebody yourself. Now, Heidi, would you suggest that as well? It's very important for the family to get their own counseling, not just be all about the addict, so that they can actually cope and help.
Yes, in the family program, we talk a lot about how the families, you know, inadvertently just get addicted to being the hero, you know, run to the rescue. And so, yes, I think that what I really love to do with the families and what we believe in here is it's a joint effort. It's not us versus them. You know, I know it can feel that way sometimes when you have to do a tough decision, like when you're with, even though like if you work with Mark and you do a Marchman app, it feels like us versus them. It's just an illusion. It's all a team. It's the whole family coming together, right? So after treatment, involving the family with the recovery planning and helping them to have their own recovery plan. You know, when I work with my clients, it's like, hey, I'll do a session with the daughter, a session with the mother, and maybe 2 weeks from now, the mother and daughter need a session together. It really is helping heal the whole family. It's not a solo journey. Although your loved one's going to go work their recovery program and you're going to work yours, there are times when we do need to come together and heal some of that stuff, right? And be on the same page. A lot of the time after treatment, children will think about coming home back to the environment, and parents need to be equipped for that. What are the ground rules? What are the boundaries? You know, there's a lot to be done around how that family dynamic's going to function in a healthy way, because it's been unhealthy for so long. So it's really important that everybody has a support system. And Al-Anon is a great free resource. And the great thing about Al-Anon is, like, you know, you're with your peers, but part of the thing about Al-Anon is you're not going to get a lot of suggestions necessarily, because, you know, it's about not being codependent and fixing people's problems. It's about, you know, figuring things out on your own. So hiring a coach, a life coach, or a family therapist, somebody who can, and coaching really is what I believe in as a master life coach. I believe in coaching because you get directions. You know, it's a little different than therapy, where you're just kind of coming in and talking and like more of listening going on and more kind of just sharing. Coaching is like, here's the game plan. Let's get the game plan together as the family, and let's have some concrete strategies. Let's figure out what to do, because that's really what families want to know. They want to know what to do. And I really help them figure that out.
So, I mean, you guys have both provided today a phenomenal toolbox for people, you know, what to do. You should definitely have, a lot of people may have not known that having a drug or alcohol attorney is very important on the team, and all the people you've suggested, Heidi. I'm just going to throw out something, though, for the people who are watching this, just because Addiction 911, we get calls and we get messages from people with no insurance and no money. And so this puts a whole different spin on this. And I don't know what advice you both could give, because, you know, the person without any money, resources, and no insurance, there's waiting lists long. This is like a harsh reality of life, and they can't hire the attorney, they can't hire the coach, they can't get coaching, the family. So, and there's just, you know, a tremendous amount of people out there. So I don't want to leave them out of this. I mean, people who have access to insurance and to resources, they can do this. So we'll start Heidi, and then we'll go to Mark. What is your suggestions? Is there anything they can do if they're in that type of situation?
Well, anybody who's made a decision to get better, there are many, many roads to Rome. And so, of course, you know, I believe in treatment because I work in treatment. But sometimes people can't afford treatment, or they have situations where they've been multiple times and they're not covered anymore. You know, they can walk in to a meeting. You know, they can go to places where other people for free, where, you know, hundreds of meetings, other places where people can have walked the road before them and hold their hand and help them through. You know, there's a lot of free resources. When you're committed to being well, anybody can be well. It's really just about doing the work necessary and figuring out what is available to you instead of focusing on what isn't. Because a lot of time that can be an excuse for people, really. Well, I don't have this, or I don't have that, and that's so nice you can hire a life coach, and that's so great you can afford Mark, but, you know, our family. Well, there's lots of free resources available. There are lots of people who are willing, if you go to a meeting and hold up your hand and say, I'm struggling, they're going to take you under their wing and help you.
And if you're the family member and you're watching this and you're wondering where these free resources are, is there any suggestions you have, anywhere to look online, in your state or any national database? I know there are some, you know, resources online. For someone, you know, a mother who's watching now, who's in that situation, I guess, you know, where would they start? Would the internet search be the best place, or?
An internet search would be a great place. And we have a lot of free resources, my husband and I. So there's one place I can send them. They can download a checklist called Helping VS Hurting, helpingversushurting.com. So it's helpingvshurting.com. And there's a free resource they can download. And once they download that free resource, it'll take them to a free webinar where they can learn the top 10 mistakes that families make. And throughout them, we direct them on how to get more help, more resources. Absolutely, going to an Al-Anon meeting where there are a multitude of other families who have been just where you have been, who are going to be able to point you in the direction of resources that have worked for them. So Al-Anon or AA or NA for the addict, and Al-Anon or Families First for the families is a great free resource that everybody should be involved in today.
Yeah. And your resource, if you can later on post that link in under the comments for everybody to get that webinar and get that. And that's great for everyone, whether, you know, you can afford treatment or not. Everyone should be watching that webinar. And Mark, what about you now as far as affordability, you know, a lawyer to being hired such as yourself? What if someone does not have the resources to hire you? What do you suggest for the legal aspect?
Look, I think there's no question that there's definitely some inequity in the system when it comes to what options are available to you if you can't afford a lawyer and you don't have health insurance and you can't afford to pay for treatment. That being said, I think Heidi's point's well taken. I mean, I think if you go to at least in Florida, go to the DCF website, Department of Children and Family Services, who license treatment centers, I think they have a list of county, what they call county receiving facilities. So I know in South County here, we have the Drug Abuse Foundation. So there are a number of facilities that will take people that, you know, are, you know, don't have the financial resources that are available. Is there going to be a waiting list? Probably, you know, and that kind of is the nature of the beast. Now, when it comes to the legal aspect of things, could they file a Marshman Act on their own? Yeah, they could probably do it on their own. They could walk down to the courthouse, go to the probate section of the courthouse, and they could fill out the paperwork. I will tell you from what the clerks tell me that people that do it on their own, you know, have somewhere between slim chance and no chance of getting it right, at least the first time anyway. And so one of the things the clerks are dealing with is people who are filing Marshman Act petitions, you know, 5, 6, 7 times because they don't have the legal training to get it right the first time. And so, you know, that what happens is it becomes a source of frustration for the family and they either end up giving up or they don't get what they're there to seek, which is to get a little bit of help from the court system. So, it's a problem, but you know, as Heidi said, if you really want to get treatment, there's lots of resources. You know, as she mentioned, I think going to that website she mentioned is a great place to start. And, you know, just doing a quick Google search, free resources, you know, maybe just Google where can I go to treatment if I don't have any money? I mean, there are places. And so it's a problem, but it's not an insurmountable problem if you really want to get it, you know, get the treatment and get the help.
That's great advice from both of you. I mean, and I'm glad we covered that too. So we're not just speaking to one demographic, you know, and that we're able to help everybody in some capacity. And just to recap, now we're coming to the end of the hour. This has been fantastic. You know, we really talked about having a team, having a plan, and, you know, utilizing it. And maybe many people who watch this weren't aware about, you know, like I said, having an attorney on the team, a therapist, a coach, all the different resources that you both mentioned and how important that is. And most important, don't go it alone. You know, if you're out there and you're loving addicts and you want to help them, but you're trying to do it all yourself, you need to reach out. You know, there are resources available. If you have insurance, there's treatment. I mean, Obamacare right now does cover most addiction issues, it's the law for right now. So, you know, you do have options to help your loved one, but you need a team and you need people who have experience like Heidi and Mark who are actually going to be there and help you. So if you're in South Florida, I want to end this with, I'll start first with Heidi and then Mark, just to recap where we can reach you, how can people get in contact with you, your website, where you're at. And just give us a little bit of that so we can end the show with those good resources. So, Heidi?
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you both. It's just been a pleasure talking to both of you guys today. I really have enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
So I can, in my, I teach at Palm Partners. So I work at Palm Partners Treatment Center, and that's a treatment center here in Delray Beach, Florida. We also have a center for women called the ORCID, which deals with women and trauma. And but I can also be found at lovecoachheidi.com, where that's my private practice. And I'm going to give you the link to the free resource. I just also want to say, if any of the families are living in South Florida locally, we offer the family program for free. And you don't have to have somebody in treatment to come through it. So if you're interested in that, you can message me at lovecoachheidi.com and I'll direct you and invite you to the family workshop. We would love to have anybody that would like to come.
Wonderful. That is fantastic. Thank you so much, Heidi. You're absolutely wonderful. Sure. And what a blessing to have you as a resource for everyone here in South Florida and anywhere else that they want to send, you know, if they're in another state and you want to send your loved one to Palm Partners and work with Heidi. Just, she's phenomenal. And Mark, so just tell us a little bit how we can reach you and your website and how somebody can get a hold of you to hire you.
So my website is drugandalcoholattorneys.com. That's drugandalcoholattorneys.com. They can email me, Mark, M-A-R-K, at drugandalcoholattorneys.com. Or they can call me, and my office number is 561-419-6095. 561-419-6095.
So. Wonderful, wonderful. And I thank you both. Thank you, Mark. You're always wonderful and it's such a valuable resource. I mean, I'm really glad that you both have come on and Mark, that you share this with us because so many people have no idea of the work you do or that Heidi does. I mean, they just don't know. And education is the most important part. And again, anybody watching this, you know, let's just end this note. Let's have compassion and love for people who are addicted and their families. And let's get rid of the stigma because this is a disease and it's killing more people probably that are dying in war right now, right? At this time of people, it's an epidemic in our country. And we all need to band together. And it starts with not, you know, judging those around you and knowing this information. If you're watching this and you just happen upon this, you know, you've got resources to recommend to people who are going through this. And if you're going through it yourself, reach out to Heidi, reach out to Mark. They're going to help you. And we hope that we helped you on this show of the Addiction 911 show. And thank you both so much. I really appreciate you taking the time and getting this information out.
Thank you, Christine. Nice to meet you, Heidi.
Bye-bye. You too.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.